Okay, so I talked just briefly earlier about how we can think of the citta, this entity that we're exploring, as being in a state that is undeveloped when it spends a lot of time with cloudy thought and other things obscuring it, and then it can become more developed and more clear and more open and more flexible and responsive. It's kind of a, we can think of it that way. That's a good way to think about it. So I want to talk a bit about the development of the citta. You know, what does that mean? What does that entail? So it can be developed when there are, first of all, certain nourishments that are in place for the process to happen. And also, the citta develops simply when we pay attention to it in the right way. So I want to talk about both of those, starting with the nourishments, the way we can nourish our practice. The first is quite foundational. It won't be surprising to anyone that the most important nourishment is ethical conduct for the cultivation of the heart and mind. And this also comes along with the mental wisdom behind behaving well. It's not merely that we're acting non-harmfully in the world because we think that we're following some externally imposed precepts, or that somebody told us to do that, or that something bad will happen to us if we don't do that. But we have simply, along with ethics, in Buddhism, we have the natural wisdom of knowing what leads toward and away from suffering. And so we just learn from our own experience, or maybe from observing others, that if we behave in ways that are counter to these simple five precepts that are offered, it doesn't go as well as when we behave in line with them. So we're protected in a way by the precepts that we're following this week, and you know, maybe you follow them ongoing anyway. And that protection itself provides something of the nourishing container in which the heart and mind can develop through practice. So, one way that you can work with the precepts, I know many of you are kind of put a check mark on them. Yeah, okay, already do that, got that. I haven't killed anybody today. But one way we can refine that when we're in more of a retreat attitude is to use this practice I suggested of feeling the body. I suggested it as a way just to come back to the present moment and always have something that we can connect to directly. But in addition, our body has a huge amount of information about what is causing tension or stress in our life. That tends to be felt in the body somehow. So, in some ways, we can go through life and feel like, okay, should I, you know, am I tense? And if I am, can I find some way to relax? That's a fine practice. In addition, we could notice if there's tension in the body, we could check, is there something stressful that I'm doing that might be causing that? You know, am I pushing a little bit, or am I shading the truth a little bit, or controlling somebody else, manipulating someone a little bit, something where there's a slight a harmful shade to it in some way. It might be very subtle, but we'll feel it if we're attuned to the tension in the body. Okay, and then secondly, this second nourishment relates to how it is that we're aware. And in the last meditation, we considered whether there might be an attitude of wanting or not wanting or slight disconnection, which I linked to greed, hatred, and delusion, the main issues that we deal with. But I also want to, now that there's more space, put a slightly different angle on this idea of the way our mind is paying attention, the way we are mindful. So it's important that we know in a way that is open and friendly, and if I can say this word, innocent in a certain way, which you know, has to do with not being judgmental or, you know, I don't know, having preconceived ideas of how things should be. And also a sense that our awareness is inclusive, meaning that everything that's there belongs there somehow. It's quite frequent that we think something shouldn't be there, you know. Why did that have to arise? Or, I don't want to have this. But actually, if something did arise, the conditions for it were there. It's certain that nothing arises without the conditions being there for it. So everything that arises is in a sense correct. It had to arise. So this attitude of inclusion or non-separation can help us not be so certain that we know what should be happening and so judgmental of what comes up. So, and it also keeps our mindful observer from being kind of detached or aloof from experience. So when we are in a sense of feeling like we're observing, that's only one way to experience mindfulness, but sometimes we experience it as being an observer. We don't want that observer to be kind of aloof. This sense of inclusion or friendliness or warmth helps us stay connected even as we're in kind of an observational mode. So there's kind of a balance. So we are creating no barriers and we're accepting everything that comes, but not getting entangled with it. So there's a certain maturity to that, you know, of allowing everything to be there, but not getting all wrapped up in it. Okay, so consciously adopting an attitude like this will tend to correct various imbalances that creep into our mindfulness throughout the day. Often these things that creep in are based on our personality or our habit patterns. And so they're things that are familiar to us already. I think most of you probably have a sense of whether or not you're generally a wanting type or a pushing type or an aversive type or a sleepy type. You know, it's not that we're, you know, typing ourselves and boxing ourselves in, but it's also wise just to know what your common habit patterns are. So I'm going to put a particular word onto this that you can see if it works for you. But I call this attitude of being open and inclusive with all of our experiences a way of having metta. I call that an aspect of metta. There are teachers who will say that metta is only for beings, and I can understand that, but I think metta is an attitude with which we can relate to any experience, whether the experience of another being or the experience of a mind state or a body state. And so I'm more of the broader definition of metta. So I want to talk about kind of three different kinds of this meta attitude, meta way of paying attention that you might recognize. There are attitudes that come in that shift our awareness a bit in ways that aren't so helpful. And certain flavors of meta can help to correct that. So those who tend to be aversive to experience, so our general attitude is, no, you know, don't come in. It's easy to be mindful in a way that's a little bit judgmental. Everything that comes in is suspect and probably wrong, pushing away in some way. So this attitude I've been trying to describe, if we would call it metta, it would allow experience to be touched and not rejected. So it's metta as a warm acceptance of what's happening. We can apply that as a counterbalance if our mind is tending to be of the aversive, judgmental, don't bother me, don't touch me kind of mind. And even if that's not our usual pattern, we can all fall prey to that sometimes. So metta as warm acceptance is nice. And then we can also have an attitude of being very self-critical and not very self-confident about our practice. And folks who have this kind of stance in the world tend to, I've noticed, not take themselves very seriously. Not that we want to take ourselves really, really seriously, but there is a way where it can be harmful to be a little bit dismissive or you know, not respectful of our practice and our experience. Oh, you know, if I'm feeling it, it's probably wrong. You know, what she's got is probably better. You know, I'm sure I'm trying this, but I'm sure I'm not really doing it very well. You know, these kinds of subtle things that creep into the background. So in this case, I would say, check for yourself that at some level, at moments like that, we're not actually deeply caring for our own well-being. And so metta is appropriate. And in this case, metta would feel like treating ourselves and our path and our practice with respect. So metta can be a respectful stance that we take in regard to our experience. So it can help to consciously bring in, especially if you sometimes fall prey to this particular attitude, a sense of respect. And then the third one that I'll mention is that we can also get a sense of conceit or self-importance or attachment to a goal. You know, I'm going to get it this time. I'm really going to nail this one. I'm going to get concentrated. I got really concentrated last time. I've been practicing for 25 years. I know how to do this. I don't know what it is for you, but these attitudes sneak in. And there's a little bit of puffing up or even just complacency that can come in. And so the key here is to notice that all of those attitudes are actually a little bit of tension. It's actually not that easeful to have to kind of prop up this sense of knowing what you're doing all the time and being very attached or wanting something, you know, clinging to getting something, getting a goal. So then we would want metta as our attitude of ease. So a sense of, okay, whatever is happening is fine, contentment, willingness to see things afresh. Yes, I've done this 25 million times, but let's see if it's new this time. So a sense of ease and contentment with just being the practice. So these three attitudes, I think, are very, very nourishing for helping the citta to feel like it's able to grow and develop. So metta as warm acceptance, metta as respect, and metta as ease, ways of relating to our experience. So you might just check those throughout the day or when you first sit down, not obsessively, but just notice, because it can help to fine tune the way that we're aware of our experience. So other nourishments, of course, include any of the wholesome qualities. So if we have any of the other three Brahma Viharas besides metta, which we'll be talking about during the week, if we have any of the factors of awakening present, which we'll be touching into also, I'm going to mention those in the Thursday talk. So we'll be cultivating all of these throughout the week. And all of these wholesome mind states are ways of purifying and strengthening the heart. You'll also notice that these nourishments are ways of touching into that heartfulness that we sometimes feel when we're doing practice or when we come to the center or when we do a day long or a retreat. We come away at the end of the day with this sense of, oh, you know, this practice is so beautiful. And then we have to go to work the next day and we think, oh, it's gone. You know, how can I have this split life where it's so wonderful and nourishing when I'm with these people and doing this thing, and then there's the rest of my life. So I'm saying, maybe they're not so different. You know, maybe they're all just aspects of the citta, whether we're thinking, doing our work, doing a spreadsheet, making a meal, talking with our partner, or sitting on the cushion, or chanting, or doing any of the beautiful practices that we do. It's all the mind, it's all our mind. And so there's a way in which we can start to infuse the parts that we think aren't that spiritual with some of these more spiritual qualities, maybe even just in the attitude that we have to being mindful of those activities. So give it a try this week. That's the beauty of one of these combined daily life and retreat experiences. So then I also want to talk a little bit now about what we're paying attention to in the citta. So that is related to the third foundation of mindfulness. So the Buddha identified citta as the third, many of you have heard of the foundation of mindfulness, right? There's four of them in the Satipatthana Sutta, the body, feeling tone, mind, that's the third one, and then dharmas is the fourth. And so mindfulness of the citta is an area where by paying attention to whatever this heart-mind experience is, cultivates mindfulness. So it's really beautiful, right? Mindfulness of the citta cultivates mindfulness, and mindfulness is a wholesome quality in our citta. So it's kind of a virtuous circle, if you will. So it's we can observe our mind. You know, what is the mind when we start looking at it? It's not that easy. Like if I asked you to point to your mind, I don't think anybody could do it. And yet we're very clear we have a mind, and we've all experienced it if we've done meditation. So it's useful to start seeing the mind, I'm going to suggest, as a set of shifting, changing mental qualities, which if in you look in the third foundation, which I'm about to read from, that's what the Buddha says it is. You look at it in that way. It's actually quite profound to see the mind in this way, rather than seeing it, say, as me or a certain personality, or it's always this way or that. So I'll just read a little bit. It's actually a fairly short section, but nonetheless, just read a little bit. So it says, how does a practitioner abide contemplating mind as mind? Here, the practitioner understands mind affected by greed as mind affected by greed, and mind unaffected by greed as mind unaffected by greed. You might say, so what? That doesn't sound very interesting. But it is quite interesting, because we have, all we're doing is noticing whether the mind is affected by this quality. Is there greed flavoring the mind right now? It's a lot like that attitude question that I asked earlier. And then it's the same for hatred and delusion. And then it also goes on to a whole bunch of other qualities, which we won't go through in detail, but contracted and distracted, you know, is the mind overly expansive or overly tight? That has a little bit to do with the energy level, like I talked about earlier. And then a bunch of qualities, like whether the mind is exalted. Well, that has to do with how wholesome it is at a given moment, whether it's concentrated and whether it's free. So we observe the quality of the citta as a way of strengthening mindfulness, and then that in turn strengthens the citta itself. So just to kind of summarize the ways in which we're aware of the mind based on this third foundation, and I encourage you to read it if you have the book, look at that again. We see the mind or the heart as it is, with no judgment. You know, it doesn't say, notice whether the mind is affected by greed, and if it is, get rid of it. It actually says, notice if it's affected by greed, notice if it's unaffected. That's it. Just notice if it's there or not. So that's kind of nice. We're not asked to do a lot with the mind. Just know how it is. Really know what's there. And if it's got hatred in it, okay. You know, as long as we're mindful, it's not going to be causing problems. Just know that, know what that's like. And maybe it's not, maybe it doesn't have that. So we're seeing both emotional tones and cognitive tones to the mind. You know, we're seeing whether it's got certain of these unskillful kind of affective qualities like greed or hatred, and also whether it has clarity, sharpness, contraction, distraction, concentration, qualities that are a little bit more mental in nature. So you can see that both of those things are in there. We also see, as we observe the mind, that these things are conditioned. So that's a word that's kind of thrown around a lot in Buddhism, but it just means that they come about because of conditions, because there are factors there that support them. Your mind is not randomly angry. It's angry because you're believing something, or something is painful when you're reacting to that. There are always reasons why those things are there at a given moment. And so we can't help, as we start observing the mind, to maybe we notice, oh, right, You know, there are these other features that are there. And so we can then not draw the conclusion, well, that's because I'm an angry person. No, it's because there are these other conditions that are there supporting the anger that's there. So we can disidentify actually with the qualities of the mind through doing the third foundation of mindfulness practices. Anālio says in his book, Satipatthana, sustained contemplation of the mind will expose the degree to which what one takes to be one's own mind is in fact influenced by external conditions. In this way, we move toward realizing non-attachment and non-identification. So even the mind is not really ours, if you will. This can be very helpful, very relieving, actually. And then finally, these qualities in the third foundation, I just want to point again toward the fact that we're sometimes seeing absence. So we're asked to see if the mind is affected by hatred and not. We're asked to see when it's concentrated and when it isn't concentrated, or when it's liberated and when it isn't. So we have this thing where we sometimes notice what's there. Is there concentration there, or is there hatred there, or is there delusion there? And sometimes we notice what isn't there. So this is a little unusual, right? Usually we're asked to be mindful of things, mindful of what's there. You can't be mindful of something that isn't there, but you can be mindful of an absence of something. It's a little bit different, isn't it? So if the mind doesn't have hatred, and we're aware of what a mind feels like without hatred, like right now, it's very unlikely that your mind has strong hatred in it. What does that feel like to be free of hatred? What does it feel like when there isn't that quality, at least not strongly, in the mind? It's interesting to know that, what space is left behind when hatred is not there, the absence of hatred. Why is that interesting? Because Nibbana is defined as the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's the definition of it, if you want a definition, if it can be defined. It's only an absence. It's an absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. If you have never observed what an absence is like, how are you going to recognize it? So we should get familiar with what it's like when our mind is not affected by the poisons. It'll help us along the path to liberation. So we cultivate the citta, we develop it by increasing the incidence of wholesome mind states, and also by seeing it clearly. Those are the two ways that we develop the citta. One is more active and one is more observational. One's a little bit more direct and energetic, if you will, and one is a little bit more, I don't want to say exactly passive, but more on the realm of letting go, just letting be. Usually we're going to need to do both in the course of developing our mind, but you know, in the end it's letting go that frees the mind. But we cultivate the citta through these two things. And we'll keep coming back to these points over the coming days in various ways. I hope you'll enjoy the practices that are offered this week and play around with them and see which ones really are meaningful and see what the result is at the end. So that's what I maybe want to say now to set us up for a week of practice, but there's some time for you to ask any questions at this point or comments on your experience today. Anything? Vicky.
I have been in practice interruptus for some time. And although I was doing for quite a long time reading the Metta Sutta every morning for quite a long time after the August retreat. And then the habit dropped. And I experienced today, and with your suggestion, was noticing when in sitting meditation that it was actually pictures, you know, in my mind, thoughts that, you know, I certainly have language, but then pictures would precede then my disappearing, seeming to drop, you know.
You mean when you lost mindfulness, when you say disappearing, is that what you mean?
Well, that's my question. I'm not sure. I'm not able to distinguish whether it was just dropping into a deeper place, which is how I used to interpret it, is my memory, or whether it just was some kind of avoidance or whatever, and somewhere, and then, you know, sometimes it's the bell or something that brings me back, and it seems like I've been gone for quite a while, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm back. But a subsequent sitting meditation today, it really did. I dropped out just as I did earlier, but then it was a short time when I came back, and then I was rather agitated.
Okay.
I'm just trying to figure out, or could appreciate any suggestions where to look to try and figure out which or neither.
Yeah, experience. So it's great. This is a wonderful question. I would bet that other folks here may have experienced something like that too. It's very common as the mind, you have a more extended period of practice, or if you have even just a long sit, for the mind to kind of drop away, but you don't remember anything about the time that it was gone particularly. It's not that you were off on a thought trail and you wake up and realize, oh, right, I was planning my next vacation. But nonetheless, it wasn't that you don't really have memory of the time that it was gone. So this is has to do with the mind balancing and getting a little out of balance as it becomes more concentrated. Actually, so as you settle in and become more gathered, we have a balance between the concentration of the mind, and which really means, you know, the gathering up, the gathering together, the settling of the mind, and the energy level of the mind. And what happens is there's a phenomenon called sinking mind, where your mind, your mindfulness is not really strong enough and your energy level starts to drop. And so you lose awareness, but you didn't go into a thought. You actually just had a little bit too much concentration for the amount of energy that you had. And your mind does what's called sinking mind. It's not actually a very helpful state. It's kind of pleasant, actually. And when you come back, you could be, you can tell, I could tell because you had a hindrance when you came back. You had agitation. You can also have dullness or something else. But the mind has gotten a little bit out of balance. And so it will correct itself if you just keep applying the mindfulness. But just be aware that what we're balancing is kind of a gathering in of the mind. But as we do that, we want the energy level to come up also. So not agitation energy, but a strong focus of awareness, if you will. I don't like to use that word very much because sometimes people then try to apply that and they make the mind really focused. But it's this energy level balance that comes in. And it can take a while for the mind to figure out how to be strongly present and with high energy at the same time. And that's what you're trying to get. You want energy and concentration both to be strong, and they will tend to be like that. So this is it's the classic working with hindrances, but after we kind of get past greed and hatred, which are the first two hindrances, or sensual desire and ill will, those are the ones that we first encounter. And that's what usually brings us on our long thought trails about wanting this or not wanting that, blah, blah, blah. Once that kind of settles out, the next two, right, are dullness and agitation. And we get to the energy level second. And when those get balanced, then we're getting very close to being concentrated. So in general, it's a good sign your mind was gathering, but it just got a little out of balance in the process. And the cure is just to keep being mindful. Mindfulness can correct that way better than our conscious mind can, because it's getting out of the realm of what we're doing in everyday life. So thank you, great question. Did that help? Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, great. Anything else, Mel?
How does one know when they're not deluded?
How does one know when one is not deluded?
Yeah, and related to that for me, but like with greed and hatred, I can identify those as like body mind states. You know, there's body feeling too. Is there a body part of body mind that experiences delusion? I mean can you feel in the body when you're deluded?
It's an interesting question. So delusion is such an interesting one, because it's, you know, we would think, how could you possibly be mindful of delusion? You know, what would that be like? But it is possible, as mindfulness gets strong, to see states that are deluded. So there are several questions in what you asked, and we're a little short on time, but I'll give a kind of a summary that I hope is helpful. One way to be deluded is to be a little bit confused or disconnected from experience. And that is mostly a mental feeling. If there were a bodily component, I suppose there could be some slight sense of disorientation, maybe in the body, a feeling of vagueness that might be somewhat physical sometimes, as the mind kind of doesn't connect very well with experience. And you can actually be aware of that state. Sometimes we're aware of that and bed in the morning before you wake up, you know, that feeling like you're kind of just arriving, but not really, you know, in and out of sleep. It's slightly different because sleep and delusion are not the same thing, but it's a similar sort of feeling if you've ever had that. And then the other way that we can experience delusion, which is quite different, is a strong sense of self is always an indication of delusion. So if we have, you know, something rise up and says, you know, I am such and such, it's like, you know, bung. And so that can be experienced as tension in the body, as, you know, focus in the mind, you know, these kinds of things. If you're having a strong sense of self, for sure, there's some kind of delusion there. And that can also be seen clearly, another way that we can see delusion. But, you know, by its nature, delusion is harder to see than greed and hatred. Often we can't see it. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, and you asked also how we can know we're not deluded. So there's a feeling of clarity, you know, when we're really seeing clearly. There are things you can't be wrong about. You know, if you have a pain in your knee, you're not deluded about that. If somebody comes along and says, no, your knee doesn't hurt, you'd say, of course it does. You know, how would you know? I can feel that. And so we have to be a little bit more careful when we get into the mind, like, I know I'm right about this, or I know I'm, you know, that we might be still deluded about. But clarity is a clear feeling. I mean, there's actually a sense in the mind of openness, of brightness, of ease, you know, no tension in the mind, so that when there's that clarity, it feels really like looking out of a clear window. And sometimes we even see the shade pull away and there's this clarity. Like when the mind first comes back into mindfulness, there's often kind of a brightness. Ah, I'm here. That moment is clarity. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, well, wanting to respect your time, then I will, I just have a few things to say to wrap up for our first day together. It's been a lovely day of practice. Thank you for your presence. I hope this has launched us well. Please remember to do the metta chant or just say it first thing tomorrow. I'll be doing it too, right along with you, to help maintain the retreat container. The recordings are going to be posted on the Albuquerque Insight website. I hope somewhat timely, but you know, Sandy is doing that for us. Thank you for that. And so please tune into your body as a way of staying in the present moment and also detecting whether or not there's tension present that might be caused by various things. And I will see you tomorrow at 7 o'clock at this same link. Are there any last questions about the sort of the structure of the retreat or anything, practical questions? We're all good on that. Cynthia.
Yes, Kim, thank you so much. Can you tell us how to send you some Dana? Where do we go to do that?
Oh, okay. It's a little, I was going to do that later, but. But it's okay. I'll put it in the chat if anybody wants to, but
okay,
it's fine. Okay. Do it again at the end. It's paypal.me/uncontrived. You just put that into your browser.
Okay.
And if you don't do PayPal, I'll have another method for you guys later.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Well, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day of practice between now and then, and be well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.